www.newsbeat.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyin min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا رافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا حسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in a last way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio coming to you from Tehran. I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start with our news bulletin. That will be followed by The Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatih al-Jinan and Kamil al-Ziyarat. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for the next hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top headline. Hamas says Israel continues to allow only a limited number of aid trucks into Gaza, which should not meet even the minimum of people's basic needs. Palestinian resistance fighters carry out another operation against Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, injuring at least one of the regime's troops. And finally, this hour, the Venezuelan president has slammed the psychological terrorism waged by the U.S., pledging that the Latin American country will stand firm against threats. Hello and welcome everyone, your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Israel has launched new strikes on different parts of the Gaza Strip in violation of the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. In Gaza City's Al-Tufah neighborhood, Israeli drones targeted homes, sparking fires inside residences. The Jabalia and the Al-Burej refugee camps also witnessed the regime's attacks. In southern Gaza, artillery and airstrikes once again targeted eastern Khan Yunis, with warplanes hitting several areas. Over 350 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire took effect in October. The death toll from the genocidal war since October 2023 has surpassed 70,100. Well, now joining us with latest updates from Deir al-Balah is our correspondent Ghada Ibrahim. Ghada, as always, thank you very much for joining us. Ghada, in addition to these continued violations, as we did mention, we also have Israeli forces have been carrying out demolitions just there of east of Gaza City. They're saying the report since early this morning. What updates do you have for us there on the ground, Ghada?
Yes, exactly. As you mentioned, the Israeli violations of the U.S. brokered ceasefire are continuous since day one of the ceasefire agreement. However, this night witnessed an escalation in these attacks. Israeli occupation army escalated its attacks on Al-Tufah neighborhood and the Asenafour area in the eastern parts of Gaza City. These areas are densely populated with residents and with displaced families. However, they were subjected to very heavy attacks since the early hours of the last night until the early hours of this morning. So many injuries were reported as a result of the Israeli quadcopters dropping bombs on the houses and on the shelters of these people and of the displaced families in these areas in particular. And according to the population and according to the locals there, the Israeli occupation army is trying to widen its circle of attacks and to expand its circle of attacking these areas as it has before widened the yellow line areas behind or in the eastern bars of the city. These areas witnessed very heavy attacks since yesterday until the early hours of the morning. Many houses broke into fire. Many people were actually injured. Many injuries arrived to Al-Ahli Al-Mahmadani Hospital. Many of them were actually in critical conditions as a result of the direct shooting and as a result of the bombs drops on the people's houses and shelters in the eastern parts of the city. In the meantime, more attacks are taking place in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city as well. The eastern parts of Bani Sahla, Abasan and Al-Qarara witnessed a wave of heavy air strikes that targeted the residential homes and the encampments in these areas. However, the Israeli occupation army is trying to level to the ground what is remaining in these areas in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city and also in the eastern parts of Gaza city as well. We are actually hearing since the early hours of the morning the Israeli detonations of the of a heavy explosive or the explosive laden repulse as we used to in the days of the genocide or during the Israeli genocide of the Gaza Strip. And the sounds are very, very like an earthquake, like it is shaking the ground beneath the people, and it is causing huge damage and huge destruction in these areas or in these in these targeted areas. The situation is really very tense for the population. Since yesterday, many families were forced to flee and to go into displacement again from the eastern bars of Gaza City and from the eastern bars of At-Tufah neighborhood towards the western bars of the Strip. However, even in the western bars of the Strip, the situation is no better, actually, because more attacks are taking place, more people are still falling victim to the humanitarian crisis, as many families are still cramming in the western bars of the city, lacking all the basics of survival as a humanitarian crisis is deteriorating every passing hour because of the Israeli restrictions on the entry of aid and on the entry of medical supplies and sheltering materials.
Exactly. Well, on that, as always, I'd like to thank you very much for those updates on the ground. Our correspondent, Ghada Ibrahim, they're joining us from Deir al-Balah. Well, the Hamas resistance movement has slammed Israel's restrictions on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza, especially tents and prefabricated homes. Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qasem stressed that existing shelters and tents are uninhabitable and cannot withstand the harsh winter conditions. He said Israel continues to allow only limited quantities of trucks into Gaza that do not meet even the minimum of basic needs of its people amid the worsening humanitarian situation. Qasem added that most trucks entering Gaza are designated for the commercial sector and carry supplementary goods that are not essential for the Palestinian people. He said Gaza needs an entry of trucks that would carry essential relief materials and in large quantities to address the large scale of the crisis faced by over 2 million people. He said the Gaza truce deal included the entry of mobile homes in order to alleviate the suffering of civilians. Qasem called on mediators and other nations to take urgent and serious action to allow the entry of mobile homes as the winter storms are hitting Gaza. The United Nations marks the annual International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people on November the 29th. This year's Day of Solidarity was marked by a diplomatic, political, and cultural program at the UN headquarters in Vienna, Austria, on Monday. Our correspondent Dieter Reinisch reports.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The United Nations Security Council, which would have the powers and the authority to take coercive measures against such extreme violations of international order and international law, has been paralyzed because what is written in its own charter, namely the veto right. In this particular case, of mainly, not only, but mainly, I mean, privilege enjoyed by the United States.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch from Reporters in Vienna.
Well, on the ground, Palestinian fighters have carried out another resistance operation against Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, injuring at least one of the regime's troops in a car ramming attack. According to Palestinian sources, the attack occurred near Al-Hul, north of the city of Al-Khalil. A large number of occupation forces were deployed to the site of the attack after its executor fled the scene. Hamas hailed the attack as a natural and legitimate answer to Israel forces' daily crimes across the occupied territories. The operation came after the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad said its fighters detonated a guided explosive device on the path of Israeli military vehicles in the town of Kabatia, hitting one of the enemy's vehicles. Al-Quds Brigades added that its fighters targeted an Israeli infantry force with several anti-personnel explosives and hand grenades. They also detonated a landmine targeting an Israeli military vehicle, causing confirmed casualties. The Israeli military confirmed that one of its troops has been killed in the occupied West Bank city of Tubas, claiming the soldier died in a driving incident. A new Israeli draft law has sparked widespread alarm among Palestinians and legal experts, who warn it represents one of the most dangerous steps towards a formal annexation of the occupied West Bank. The legislation would allow Israeli settlers and foreign Jews to legally purchase land in the West Bank for the first time by canceling a 1953 Jordanian law that has, until now, prohibited foreign ownership. Our correspondent Akat Hamid has more.
In the occupied West Bank, a newly proposed Israeli law is setting off alarm bells. For decades, Palestinians relied on the Jordanian property law of 1953. Which bars non-Jordanian, non-Palestinians, and non-Arabs from owning land as one of the few remaining legal shields against settler land appropriation. But now the Israeli draft law seeks to abolish that protection entirely, opening the door for settlers, settler organizations, and foreign Jews to legally purchase land inside the West Bank.
The Israeli occupation's main objective in the West Bank is land seizure. It cannot sustain its project without controlling territory, so it uses every legal and military excuse from Ottoman land laws to expropriation orders and natural reserve declarations.
Legal experts say that the cancellation of the 1953 law is not a technical amendment, but a strategic move, one that removes the last remaining barrier to transforming privately owned and communal Palestinian land into settler-controlled territories.
Israel is trying to legitimize the land seizure through every possible method, from confiscation to declaring Palestinian areas as military zones or firing ranges. Today, we are entering a new phase where Israel seeks to impose its own laws on the West Bank. This amounts to de facto annexation, even if formal annexation has not been officially declared due to international pressure.
The shift bypasses long-standing protections and dismantles the legal barriers that once limited settler expansion, giving individuals the power to reshape the map of the West Bank.
Allowing Israelis to purchase land in the West Bank turns years of fraudulent land appropriation into a formal legal process. Israel refuses to recognize thousands of Palestinian land titles dating back to the Ottoman and Jordanian periods. This is a gradual annexation carried out through military force, land confiscation, and now the legalization of settler ownership over Palestinian lands.
Rights groups say that new legislation is not happening in isolation. It comes alongside rising settler violence, home demolitions, and expanding military zones, creating a coordinated environment where Palestinians are steadily pushed off their land.
In a landscape already fractured by settlements, bypass roads, and military orders, this new law pushes Palestinians into an even narrower space, legally, politically, and physically. For many here, it is the clearest sign that annexation is no longer a threat. It is a reality. Naqa Hamad, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Iran's foreign minister says the United States must regain Tehran's trust before returning to diplomacy with the Islamic Republic. Abbas Araghchi was speaking in a phone conversation with his Japanese counterpart, Motegi Toshimitsu. The two top diplomats were discussing the latest developments related to Iran's peaceful nuclear program and the positions taken by the United States and the European Troika. Araghchi expressed hope that Tehran and Tokyo would continue close and effective cooperation given their history of constructive ties. The Japanese foreign minister, for his part, reiterated his country's commitment to playing a constructive role in promoting peace and stability in West Asia. He said Tokyo supports political initiatives for the resolution of regional and international issues. Crossing over to Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro, who has vowed that his country will stand firm against U.S. threats, slamming the campaign of psychological terrorism waged by Washington.
We have lived through 22 weeks of an aggression that can be described as psychological terrorism. These 22 weeks have put us to the test, and the people of Venezuela have shown their love for the homeland. If 22 weeks ago we loved Venezuela, today we love her infinitely, and we are willing to continue defending her and to lead her down safe paths of peace.
Maduro was addressing crowds of his supporters outside the presidential palace in Caracas. He warned that Venezuela will resist any attempt to impose a political change by force. Maduro added that his people do not want, quote, a slave's peace nor the peace of colonies. U.S. President Donald Trump has escalated pressure on Caracas with a major naval buildup in the Caribbean. The Venezuelan government says the buildup and attacks on alleged drug trafficking vessels are part of a broader U.S. effort to topple Maduro and seize control of the country's oil reserves.
Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
ocean of dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith, and all of you who are listening to RIB English Radio. You're listening to the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this program, we try to discuss the different concepts and meanings and try to interpret the passages of different supplications that have been issued by the Ma'sumin, peace be upon them. We were continuing the discussion on the supplication of Sabah, Dua al-Sabah, and let's listen to one passage of this supplication, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk more about that passage.
Ya man dalla ala dhatihi bi dhatihi وتنزه عن مجانسة مخلوقاته وجل عن ملائمة كيفياته.
We listen to the passage of this dua, which reads, يا من دل على ذاته بذاته. It's been translated as, O he who demonstrates his essence by his essence. Now, dalla can be translated in various ways. It could mean that he is the reason of his essence, that no one knows his essence except himself. Okay? Because we have dalil, which means reason. Dalla ala dhatihi bidhatihi means that he doesn't need a reason for his existence. Because no one can understand his existence. Only he himself is the one who has, who can demonstrate his essence. This is really complicated. That is why our imams have told us, do not focus too much and try to understand the that of Allah, the essence of Allah. Okay? So it's something that we just can't comprehend. It's something beyond our intellect. The essence of Allah, that of Allah. Okay, so when Allah says, no one knows his essence, Subhanallah amma yasifun, laysa kamithlihi shay. So it means we just can't even imagine what he is like. Okay? Yes, we know his sifat. We know his attributes. We know that his attributes are not separate from his essence. Okay? But we should not think too much of the essence of Allah, because it might mislead us. Okay? Only the a'immah, the imams, they are the ones who have all of the things that one can know about Allah. Okay? So we should not try to discover the essence of Allah with our limited knowledge, with our limited intellect. And only Allah himself, he does dalla ala dhati. He is the one who knows his essence. Okay, who demonstrates his essence. Now, this is the English translation. It's interesting that in different languages, this passage has been translated in a different way. Like the Persian says that, O he whose essence is the reason for his essence. Okay. So Let's listen to the next passage of this supplication and find out what exactly the Imam means by this saying that the essence of Allah, Allah only can demonstrate his essence. See, like, I can't even put these to words. This is how difficult it is. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back.
Oh, he who demonstrates his essence by his essence transcends from congeniality with his creatures and is exalted beyond conformity with his qualities. Oh, he who is near to the passing thoughts of opinions, far from the regards of eyes, and knows what will be before it comes to be.
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable.
You're listening to Arabi English Radio. This is the Ocean of Dua. The next passage says, وَتَنَزَّهَ عَمْ مُجَانَسَةِ مَخْلُوقَاتِهِ. تَنَزَّهَ means he is clear. It is far from Allah. Allah is glorious. Here it says transcends. That could be also a good translation. وَتَنَزَّهَ عَمْ مُجَانَسَةِ مَخْلُوقَاتِهِ transcends from congeniality with his creatures. That means that Allah is nothing like his creatures, the things that he has created. لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٌ وَهُوَ السَّمِيعُ الْبَصِيرُ. So we have a body, we have a physical body, we have hands, we have eyes, we have imagination, we have anything that we can describe for ourselves. Allah is above all of that. Subhanallahi amma yasifun. Subhanallahi amma yushrikun. When the Christians, they said, Allah has a son. Allah has a son, Jesus Christ, which is completely false. Allah says, Subhanah. That means he is clear from such attributions. Subhanahu idha qada amran fa innama yaqulu lahu kun fayakun. It's very easy for Allah to make a human being to be born from a mother without a husband. It's not difficult for Allah to do that. He can make that happen because Allah is capable of everything. We are just the means of Allah. So, my dear brothers and sisters, when we think of Allah, when certain thoughts cross our minds about Allah, we have to know that Allah is a lot greater than those thoughts that cross our minds, because he is not like us. He has created everything. He has created matter. He has created ghaib, the things we see, the things we don't see, spiritual things, material things. But he is above all of that. He has created time. Allah existed before anything called time existed, before we could say past, present, and future. Allah existed before that notion even, because this is what he has created, and that's why we say that he is above everything that we can imagine. Tanazzaha. He transcends from congeniality with his creatures. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, I leave you in the care and protection of Allah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism, and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by investigative journalist and author Matt Kennard. Matt is the co-author of Silent Coup, How Corporations Overthrew Democracy, and the author of two other acclaimed books. He used to be a staff writer at the Financial Times in New York, Washington, D.C., and London. He then served as a fellow and later director of the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London, and he co-founded Declassified UK. He is now an independent journalist. Thank you very much for joining me today, Matt. I want to go straight into talking with you about Britain's active involvement, not just complicity, in the genocide that's being perpetrated in Gaza. In January 2024, you broke a story about how Britain had conducted 50 spy flights over Gaza in support of Israel. That number is now over 500. And you've continued to cover that issue, which until recently was totally not just ignored, but I would say covered up by the mainstream media. Before we get into how and why that mission has come to an end, could you give us a recap about what these spy flights are and what they were all about?
Yeah, well, as you say, these spy flights are the key component of UK support for Israel's genocide, which makes it active participation rather than complicity because, and this is not just me saying this, this is legal experts, if you are providing intelligence from over a territory being attacked by a genocidal power, you are a party to that conflict. And you're giving intelligence, which to this day we still don't know what that intelligence is, and we don't know what departments of the Israeli state they're providing it to. But these flights were announced in December 2023 by the Tory administration at that point. And it was just a government press release, and they did not say where they were going from, how long they were going to be in the sky, what plane would be used, or anything about it. And so I started looking on flight tracking websites and found where the plane was going from, which was RAF at Criterion, Cyprus, which I'd been working on up to that point anyway, because that's the key international site for all the international support for Israel in terms of arms supplies, spies being sent, logistics support since the genocide started and continues now. But anyway, so I started seeing these flights go, saw that they were Shadow R1 planes, which are intelligence, reconnaissance and surveillance planes, which can really get granular detail on the ground. And one of their main capabilities is target acquisition for military strikes. I saw they were going every day as well, and they'd basically gone every day up till about a week ago. And they're in the sky for 6 hours, one of those hours is getting to and from Gaza from our RF Equatorial on Cyprus, 5 hours over Gaza, just collecting intelligence. Now, we never knew what their flight path was over Gaza, because what happened was about halfway to Gaza, they turned the transponder off. Then on the way back, they turned the transponder back on. So there's massive amounts of secrecy around it, and also not just around the flights themselves, but around what intelligence is being collected and how it's being used by Israel. Because when they've had to defend it, the government, which is very little, because as you say, the mainstream media has barely covered it. In fact, they haven't covered it at all, really. But when they've had to defend it, when they've been asked questions in Parliament by MPs, who have, some of them have been quite dogged, all they say is, well, it's all to do with hostage rescue. And we only give intelligence to the relevant authorities. They never say what those relevant authorities are. But think about it. That's semantic wordplay. Israel characterizes their whole genocide as a hostage rescue operation. The relevant authorities for hostage rescue must be the occupation forces and their intelligence agencies, because they're the one leading the campaign. So I think we need much more will come out over the coming years. And hopefully, and this is why I believe that the ICC and the ICJ need to get involved, because the process of legal discovery would mean that we could get a lot of information that we can't as journalists, because we're talking about institutions and agencies within the UK state, which are the most secret parts of the UK state, the intelligence agencies. And they're not secret to defend us. Maybe there's a little bit of secrecy they need for their operations, but 95% of it is to defend themselves from us. All this stuff has been got from open source. There's been no actual whistleblower from within the program. So if you started scratching the surface, I'm sure it would completely unravel, and you'd find out that we have been for nearly 2 years just active participants in a very direct way. So it's hugely important. I mean, this is, and it goes to what you were saying about the media. I sometimes can't understand how it's just, and a few other journalists, but it's basically been me covering this story. There's no more serious crime than genocide that a state can commit. And when you're talking about our government actively participating in it, this should be like every journalist in the country that's covering this stuff should be going any avenue they can to get the information, and there's been nothing. And I think it goes to the heart of what the media in this country is for. We don't have a media in the sense of how it's commonly understood. What we have is a propaganda system. And Gaza has exposed that, I think, like never before. Gaza has exposed many, many different myths that we live by in this country and globally. But one of the biggest ones is that we have this crusading free press, fourth estate, which holds power to account. We don't at all. It operates 99% of the time as a arm of the state itself. And the other 1%, when they're actually doing critical stories, they're always surface scandals. They're nothing that tells you anything about the systematic workings of the British state. And definitely don't tell you anything about the secretive agencies, which have a lot of power in this country and are basically never covered. So, it's been a pretty eye-opening experience covering this stuff. And also, the other thing, which I should mention, is Spyfires is only one component. And there's obviously the arms that have been going. 150,000 bullets were sent to Israel soon after October 7th, when the genocide started. They've been sending armored tanks, all sorts of different military equipment. They also have sent parts for the F-35 plane, which became controversial recently because they, when Labour announced a partial suspension of arms to Israel in September 2024, they carved out the parts for the F-35 jet, which 15% of which is produced in the UK, which is absurd. Because how can you say, well, our lawyers have said that any weapons that go to Israel that can be used in Gaza run the risk of being used in violations of international humanitarian law, and leave out the part, which is the parts for the main bit of technology which is carrying out that genocide? It doesn't make any sense on a legal terms. And in fact, there was a recent case which was lost insanely by two human rights groups to try and get the government to stop the F-35 parts. Anyway, then there's also the SAS, which again is not talked about at all. In fact, there was the only mention of the SAS in Gaza was in the mainstream media on October 27th. There was an article in The Sun, and this is how the SAS work. They're not against leaks, but they only do official leaks, and always there to present the SAS as this heroic institution. So in October 27th, 2023, there was an article in The Sun, which was based on sources saying that the SAS had deployed to Cyprus for Gaza operations. Heroic hostage rescue operations. following day, a D notice was sent out by the Ministry of Defence to all media to say you can't publish anything more about UK Special Forces in Gaza. To this day, there's not been a single bit of information which has come out in the media about what those Special Forces have been doing. I actually recently published that D notice because I got hold of it. Again, it goes back to the media point. I mean, and means they're complicit. If they have information, have received information about our Special Forces being involved in Israel or on the ground in Gaza, it's not preposterous to think that could have happened. And they've not published it because they've been told by the Ministry of Defence that there's a D-notice. They're complicit because the D-notice is officially voluntary. So there's not even any punitive... I mean, there might be sort of like unofficial punitive measures that can be taken against newspapers, but the fact that we've had no more information, the fact that they kept that D-notice secret, the D-notice I published for the first time had gone to every single media editor in the UK, and not one thought it would be the right moral thing to publicise it. The only way we knew about its existence was a socialist worker wrote a story about it. They didn't publish the D-notice itself, but that was a big service in itself. But so it's deep, deep complicity. I don't think you can think of the Gaza genocide as just an Israeli genocide. And I say this all the time, so I'm sure people are bored of hearing it, but it is a tripartite genocide. It's the US, it's the UK, and it's Israel. Now, the US providing the vast majority of the arms, also Special Forces, by the way. It was reported early in the genocide that US Special Forces had been deployed to Israel. Britain providing the majority of the intelligence, it seems, or that's their role. And Israel getting it done because, and I'll finish with this, just on the spy flights where we started, subsequent to the work we were doing, there was an investigation by Al Jazeera into reconnaissance flights over Gaza. This came out last year, 2024. And they found that 47% of all reconnaissance flights over Gaza were flown by the RAF, which was more than double Israel itself. So how are you not a party to a conflict if that's the stats that have been gathered from open source intelligence? And the UK government admits they're giving that intelligence to Israel. They don't say what departments or what it's for, or apart from hostage rescue. But to me, there's no confusion. If we lived in a world which actually applied international law, UK ministers would be getting arrest warrants from the ICC now. And again, we talk a lot about Starmer and Lammy and John Healey, who's the defence secretary. But this also goes for the previous Conservative administration, who started the spy flights themselves. So Rishi Sunak, Grant Shapps, who was Defence Secretary, David Cameron, who was Foreign Secretary. So there's a whole coterie of war criminals that have served in the UK government and been complicit in, and participants, in fact, in one of the worst crimes in modern history, maybe in all history. So it's going to take years of work to unravel the reality of what's happening, because, as I say, what we know now is the result of independent journalists using mostly open source stuff. So as soon as over the years, when we get more whistleblowers, when we get more information, hopefully from legal cases and other avenues, we'll get a much more full understanding. And that's why I always say, like, this won't stop when the genocide finishes. This is a years of work that we're all going to be dedicated to, because we have to hold the people that are accountable for this to justice, because if we don't, then we just accept that we live in a genocidal world and the law of the jungle rules, and we can't accept that. So it's imperative to stop it happening again, but also just to stop the complete disintegration of our society, that we hold accountable the people that did this. And obviously, we have some hope in the ICC arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gallant, because although they took too long, that's the first time Western leaders have been... and our allies have been prosecuted, despite us being the most violent and war criminal countries in the world. So the fact that that threshold was crossed means that the idea that our own prime minister or the US president, or it would be hard for the US president because they're not part of the ICC, but, you know, the people that we assume, and people would be shocked if you said they're going to be in the restaurant, we need to change that idea, and we need to say, we need to understand that the ICC was essentially created as an imperial tool, and it was created to go after official enemies, which is what it did up to the Gaza genocide.
I agree completely on that, and of course we praise you for the work that you've done in exposing all of this. I think because of your doggedness in pursuing the government on these sorts of matters. You were even blacklisted at one point by the UK Ministry of Defence.
Yeah, that was earlier on at the classified. That was actually a very salutary tale of how the media system worked. That happened like about a year into us founding Declassified. And I did a story basically about how MI5 and MI6 were training spies from some of the worst dictatorships in the world, like the Saudis, the Egyptians, the UAE, you know, at a base called Chick Sands just outside London. And like always, I contacted the MOD for comment, because it was an MOD course that they were training them on. And they just didn't respond. And then I called them and they said, we'll get back to you. And they didn't respond. So I was very, like, sort of like, they never do this. This is the first time this has happened. And then a couple of weeks later, there was a protest by Ahmed Al-Batati. I don't know if you remember him. Yes. He was a Yemeni soldier. Oh, sorry, a British soldier, but British Yemeni, who was serving in the Ministry of Defence and went out in his fatigues outside the Ministry of Defence and blew a whistle every minute to symbolise how many Yemenis were dying because of the British war in Yemen, which it was a British war, it wasn't just a Saudi war. He got arrested by military police and then discharged. But anyway, when he was taken in, Phil Miller, my colleague, contacted the Ministry of Defence for comment about what had happened to him, what the process was, and they didn't get back to him. And then he called them again, and he was recording the call, and the officer and the press officer said, oh, we don't deal with your publication anymore. Which is a contravention of the civil service code, by the way, because you're meant to, you have to interact with all journalists despite their political affiliations or style of journalism. And then they probably thought, well, this is a small website, nothing's going to happen. But it escalated, and a Council of Europe media alert was sent out, level two, which is quite a big deal, and also means, because the Council of Europe, the UK's part of, meant that the Ministry of Defence had to respond. So anyway, Ben Wallace, who was then Defence Secretary, ordered a inquiry, which was carried out by Tony Blair's former spokesperson, not Alistair Campbell, another one. And he published a report which showed essentially that we'd been blacklisted, but yet Ben Wallace still didn't accept that there was a blacklisting in his place. He said it appeared to many people in the press office that it was a blacklisting. It was just like legalese. But the interesting thing was he that whole report, which was quite shocking, by the way, it was like anonymous military officers said we need to put them on a list of hostile media organizations. You don't know what that means within the context. So they published that report, which was a long report, very, very shocking and worrying for the free press. Then Wallace gets up in the House of Commons, apologises to Declassified UK, which is kind of unprecedented, and still to this day, not a single word about it has ever appeared in the mainstream media, which is crazy, because when you talk about that level of response, like you would imagine, and the Council of Europe, you expect that the mainstream media, who you would think would defend fellow journalists who are actually doing proper work, unlike them, they didn't. But that was, again, it goes to show that the Ministry of Defence just did not know how to deal with journalists who, I mean, we were, and they still are, don't take any state or corporate funding, completely independent, not working for any hostile powers or anything. But they just couldn't accept journalists, or didn't understand journalists, that were asking questions in a critical way to try and find out information that the government didn't want out. Like, literally, if you look at the main defence correspondents from, like, Jonathan Beale at the BBC, Deborah Haynes at Sky News, nearly everything they publish is just a reworded MOD press release. It's shocking. Well,
Jonathan Beale recently decried the reporting on these spy flights. I think he attacked Des Friedman and also maybe John McAvoy at Declassified for reporting on it. And he asked, and I'm paraphrasing, whether they had access to some secretive privileged information. And it's like, well, this is all publicly sourced. If you're doing your job, you'd have also discovered this.
It's a mindset. That's the interesting thing. That's my take on a propaganda system. It's not that he is being controlled. It's just that he has not ever got in his head an idea that he wants to find out information that the government doesn't want out, because he's so immersed in that mainstream media world, especially at the BBC, where you're just an appendage of the state. The thought to actually maybe do a bit of independent research never crosses his mind. It's that It's that Noam Chomsky interview with Andrew Marr, you know, when Andrew Marr says, do you believe I don't think what I say? And he said, no, you think what you say, but you wouldn't be where you are if you thought any different. So anyone who does critical journalism gets filtered out way before they get to the level of Jonathan Beale. And that's the way it works. And that's why and that's why it's quite funny when they respond like that, because they're not aware of it. They always say, well, I can write what I want and I can do what I want. It's like, well, that's because you never say anything that the state doesn't like. If you did, you'd soon find out that they wouldn't allow you to continue. But it's but as you say, I mean, you said active participants. I'd say they're complicit, definitely, because if you like to go back to the F-35 September 2024 suspensions by Labour, right? That only happened because when the media has focused on UK role, it's always on arms, which is good. Like, obviously, I think there should be a complete arms embargo. There should have been one a long time ago. But the government was pressured by that media pressure and mainstream media pressure. If that mainstream media had borne that pressure on the spy flights, they would have been grounded a year ago or more.
Well, also, just speaking of complicity, you recently broke a story about numerous Israeli jets of an active in perpetrating the Gaza genocide have been landing in Britain.
Yeah, mad. Not picked up at all by the mainstream media as it never is. But yeah, that's active participation, because these are Israeli tankers. They're called Reem air-to-air refueling planes. Yeah, they landed at Bryce Norton 9 times. At least that's what we could find. I'm sure there's more. But they landed at RF Bryce Norton all under the Labour government. And then days later, on some occasions, they were flying off Gaza, refueling fighter jets when there were massacres of nearly 100 people in one in Beit Lahia. And it just got. And then recently, the head of the Israeli Air Force came and attended the air tattoo at a UK military base. This is a guy that is basically the architect of, in terms of the air war, of the genocide, and he's been welcomed by the Labour government. It is astounding, the level of complicity and participation. And it goes to the fact that I think that effectively we are occupied by the Israeli state in many ways through different mechanisms. One is the official Israel lobby, like the Israeli embassy and its various different agencies, but also through the groups they have within our political system, like Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, which are front groups for the embassy, both of whom don't reveal their funders. But, you know, in that Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, Michael Rubin, who was then the parliamentary officer for the LFI, was recorded outside a pub saying, well, we work closely with the embassy and they send us things to say when there's trouble for Israel. So effectively, every statement you see posted by LFI is probably drafted by the Israeli embassy, highly likely. That's one section. Then there's the other section, which is nominally Jewish groups that are meant to represent Jewish interests or Jewish communal interests that have been infiltrated by the Israeli embassy and the Zionist movement and made to work, like the Jewish labor movement. There's not hard evidence of links to the embassy, although Ella Rose was at the Israeli embassy and then became head of Jewish labor movement, I think. But it's clear from their statements that they're basically operating as an Israel lobby group. The same with the
Even in the Jewish labor movement constitution, they're bound to support Israel.
Exactly. Yeah, and the Board of Deputies of British Jews, right, which is again presents itself as a Jewish communal group representing the community in Britain. It's explicitly an Israel lobby group, because if you look at the parliamentary records of ministers' meetings, they say the Board of Deputies is coming in, and what do they say they're talking about? Israel-Palestine, and they're arguing the case for Israel. It's see-through. So you've got that element as well. And then you've got the media that is and that these organizations play a role. But the other way that we're occupied is there's various mechanisms that can be used to stop the ascent of a leader who might take decisions which are to the detriment of Israel, which we saw very clearly with Jeremy Corbyn. And he gets criticized for not being radical enough on his Israel policy, which, fair enough, I agree with that. But in both manifestos, he said there would be an arms embargo on Israel in terms of weapons that could be used in human rights violations against Palestinians. Like, that was completely unprecedented. I don't think it ever appeared in the mainstream. And how was he destroyed? One of the main mechanisms was that the bogus anti-Semitism campaign, which began as soon as he was elected leader. Before that, and actually, Ed Miliband, who was the leader before Corbyn, he also came under, so, because he wanted to recognise Palestine. People forget this whole episode, and there was a whole fake anti-Semitism thing around him as well. So there's various mechanisms which mean it's very, very hard, in fact, maybe impossible for the British state and its different agencies like the military to put a hand up and say no to Israel. And that's just the proof's in the pudding. If we're inviting a guy who's the head of the Air Force when his boss, the Prime Minister, has an ICC arrest warrant out to the UK to talk for meetings, that something's wrong. If we're allowing the Israeli planes that are involved in the bombing of Gaza, which has been orchestrated by a Prime Minister who's got an ICC arrest warrant out, how that doesn't make sense in any way unless to say that the British state is not acting in its own interest or in our interest. It goes, I mean, there's another example I've looked into, which is the prescription thing, right? Prescription of Palestine action was pushed by the Israel lobby. Prescription of Hezbollah was pushed by the Israel lobby. Both those things, I think, if even the British establishment had control over the things, wouldn't have done. One, because Palestine action is so preposterous, it's just, it's become unworkable and it's an embarrassment now. On the Hezbollah thing, they got two ministers in the Lebanese government. The British government don't want to, in terms of British national interest, they don't want to alienate and make it impossible to negotiate, to deal with people in positions of power
This is why I think, you know, Britain has lost a lot of its diplomatic capital around the world, particularly through this prescription regime, which is why global diplomacy now doesn't happen out of London, it happens out of Doha in Qatar.
He spoke words so beautiful. It's when he